Cave of the Ancients by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend, November 2016. Chapter 8. It was pleasant indeed, lying in the cool, long grass at the base of the Pargo Kaling. Above me, at my back, the ancient stones soared heavenwards, and, from my viewpoint flat on the ground, the point so high above seemed to scrape the clouds. Appropriately enough, the bud of the lotus, forming the point, symbolized spirit, while the leaves, which supported the bud, represented air. I, at the base, rested comfortably against the representation of life on earth. Just beneath my reach, unless I stood, were the steps of attainment. Well, I was trying to attain now. It was pleasant lying here and watching the traders from India, China, and Burma come trudging by. Some of them were afoot, while leading long trains of animals carrying exotic goods from far, far places. Others, more grand, maybe, or possibly just plain tired, rode and gazed about. I speculated idly on what their pannier bags contained, then pulled myself together with a jerk. That was why I was here. I was here to watch the aura of as many different people as I could. I was here to divine from the aura and from telepathy what these men were doing, what they were thinking, and what were their intentions. Just off to the opposite side of the road, a poor blind beggar sat. He was covered with dirt. Ragged and commonplace, he sat and whined at passing travelers. A surprising number threw coins to him, delighting in watching him, blind, scrabble for the falling coins and finally locating them by the sound they made as they struck the earth and perhaps chinked against a stone. Occasionally, very occasionally indeed, he would miss a small coin, and the traveler would lift it up and drop it again. Thinking of him, I turned my lazy head in his direction and sat upright in sheer dazed astonishment. His aura! I had never bothered to observe it before. Now, looking carefully, I saw that he was not blind. I saw that he was rich, had money and goods stored away, and that he was pretending to be a poor blind beggar, as it was the easiest way of making a living that he knew. No, it couldn't be. I was mistaken. I was overconfident or something. Perhaps my powers were failing. Troubled at such a thought, I stumbled to my reluctant feet and went in search of enlightenment from my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, who was at the Kundu Ling opposite. Some weeks before, I had undergone an operation in order that my third eye might be the more widely opened. From birth, I had been possessed of unusual powers of clairvoyance, with the ability to see the aura around the bodies of humans, animals, and plants. The painful operation had succeeded in increasing my powers far more than had been anticipated even by the Lama Mingyar Dondop. Now my development was being rushed, my training in all occult matters occupied my waking hours. I felt squeezed by mighty forces as this Lama and that Lama pumped knowledge into me by telepathy and by other strange forces whose workings I was now so intensively studying. Why do classwork when one can be taught by telepathy? Why wonder at a man's intentions when one can see from his aura? But I was wondering about that blind man. "Oh, Honorable Lama, where are you?" I cried, running across the road in search of my guide. Into the little park I stumbled, almost tripping over my eager feet. "So," smiled my guide, sitting peacefully on a fallen bowl, "so, you are excited. You've just discovered that the blind man sees as well as you do." I stood panting, panting from lack of breath and from indignation. "Yes," I exclaimed, "the man is a fraud, a robber, for he steals from those of good heart. He should be put in prison." The Lama burst out laughing at my red, indignant face. "But Lobsang," he said mildly, "why all the commotion? That man is selling service as much as the man who sells prayer wheels. People give insignificant coins to him that they may be thought generous. It makes them feel good. For a time it increases their rate of molecular vibration, raises their spirituality, places them nearer the gods. It does them good. The coins he give, nothing. They don't miss them." "But he's not blind," I said in exasperation. "He's a robber." "Lobsang," said my guide, "he's harmless. He's selling service. Later, in the Western world, you will find that advertising people will make claims the falsity of which will injure one's health, will deform babies yet unborn, and will transform the passively sane into raving maniacs." He patted the fallen tree and motioned for me to sit beside him. I sat and drummed my heels on the bark. "You must practice using the aura and telepathy together," said my guide. "By using one and not the other, your conclusions may be warped, as in this case. It is essential to use all one's faculties. Bring all one's power to bear on each and every problem. Now, this afternoon I have to go away, and the great medical lama, the Reverend Chinro Bono of the Mezkang Hospital, will talk to you, and you will talk to him." "Oh," I said ruefully, "but he never speaks to me. He never even notices me." "All that will be changed one way or another this afternoon," said my guide. "One way or another," I thought. That looked very ominous. Together, my guide and I walked back to the Iron Mountain, pausing momentarily to gaze anew at the old yet always fresh rock-colored carvings. Then we ascended the steep and stony path. "Like life, this path," Lobsang. Life follows a hard and stony path, with many traps and pitfalls, said my lama. Yet if one perseveres, the top is attained. As we reached the top of the path, the call to temple service was made, and we each went our own way, he to his associates, and I to others of my class. As soon as the service had ended, and I had partaken of food, a chela, even smaller than I, came somewhat nervously to me. "Tuesday, Lobsang," he said diffidently, "the holy medical lama, Chinro Bono, wants to see you immediately in the medical school." I straightened my robe, took a few deep breaths that my twanging nerves might be calmed, and walked with assurance that I didn't feel over to the medical school. "Ah!" boomed a great voice, a voice that reminded me of the sound of a deep temple conch. I stood before him and paid my respects in the time-honored way. The lama was a big man, tall, bulky, broad-shouldered, and a wholly awe-inspiring figure for a small boy. I felt that a swipe from one of his mighty hands would knock my head straight off my shoulders and send it tumbling down the mountainside. However, he bade me be seated before him, bade me in such a genial manner that I almost fell into a sitting position. "Now, boy," said the great deep voice, like rolling thunder among the distant mountains, "I have heard much of you. Your illustrious guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, claims that you are a protege, that your paranormal abilities are immense. We shall see." I sat and quaked. "You see me? What do you see?" he asked. I quaked even more as I said the first thing that entered my mind. "I see such a big man, holy medical lama, that I thought it was a mountain when I came here first." His boisterous laugh caused such a gale of wind that I half feared that it would blow my robe off. "Look at me, boy, look at my aura, and tell me what you see," he commanded. Then, "Tell me what you see of the aura and what it means to you." I looked at him, not directly, not staring, for that often dims the aura of a clothed figure. I looked toward him, but not exactly at him. "Sir," I said, "I see first the physical outline of your body, dimly as it would be without a robe. Then very close to you, I see a faint bluish light, the color of fresh wood smoke. It tells me that you have been working too hard, that you have had sleepless nights of late, and your etheric energy is low." He smiled at me with eyes somewhat wider than normal and nodded in satisfaction. "Go on," he said. "Sir," I continued, "your aura extends from you a distance of about 9 feet on either side. The colors are in layers, both vertical and horizontal. You have the yellow of high spirituality. At present you are marveling that one of my age can tell you so much, and you are thinking that my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, knows something after all. You are thinking that you will have to apologize to him for your expressed doubts as to my capabilities. I was interrupted by a great shout of laughter. You are right, boy, you are right, he said delightedly. Go on. Sir, this was child's play to me. You recently had some mishap and sustained a blow over your liver. It hurt you when you laugh too hard, and you wonder if you should take some tatura herb and have deep massage while under its anesthetic influence. You are thinking that it is fate which decided that of more than 6,000 herbs, tatura should be in short supply. He was not laughing now. He was looking at me with undisguised respect. I added, it is further indicated in your aura, sir, that in a short time you will be the most important medical abbot of Tibet. He gazed at me with some apprehension. My boy, he said, you have a great power. You will go far. Never, never abuse the power within you. It can be dangerous. Now, let us discuss the aura as equals, but let us discuss over tea. He raised the small silver bell and shook it so violently that I feared it would fly from his hand. Within seconds, a young monk hastened in with tea and, oh, joy of joys, some of the luxuries of Mother India. As we sat there, I reflected that all these high lamas had comfortable quarters. Below us, I could see the great parks of Lhasa, the Dodpal, and the Kakti were, so it appeared, within reach of my extended arm. More to the left, the Chartan of our area, the Kesar Lakang, stood like a sentinel, while across the road, further north, my favorite spot, the Pargo Kaling, Western Gate, towered aloft. What causes the aura, sir? I asked. As your respected guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, has told you, he commenced, the brain receives messages from the Overself. Electric currents are generated in the brain. The whole of life is electric. The aura is a manifestation of electric power. About one's head, as you well know, there is a halo or nimbus. Old paintings always show a saint or god with such a golden bowl around the back of the head. Why do so few people see the aura and the halo, sir? I asked. Some people disbelieve the existence of the aura because they cannot see it. They forget that they cannot see air either, and without air they would not manage very well. Some, a very, very few, people see auras. Others do not. Some people can hear higher frequencies or lower frequencies than others. It has nothing to do with the degree of spirituality of the observer, any more than the ability to walk on stilts indicates a necessarily spiritual person. He smiled at me and added, I used to walk on stilts almost as well as you. Now my figure is not suited for it." I smiled too, thinking that he would need a pair of tree trunks as stilts. "When we operated upon you for the opening of the third eye," said the great medical lama, "we were able to observe the portions of your frontal lobe developments were very different from the average, and so we assume that physically you were born to be clairvoyant and telepathic. That is one of the reasons you have received and will receive such intensive and advanced training." He looked at me with immense satisfaction and continued, "You are going to have to remain here at the medical school for a few days. We're going to investigate you thoroughly and see how much we can even increase your abilities and teach you much." There was a discreet cough at the door, and my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, walked into the room. I jumped to my feet and bowed to him, as did the great Chin Ro Nobo. My guide was smiling. "I received your telepathic message," he said to the great medical Lama, "so I came to you as speedily as I was able, so that perhaps you would give me the pleasure of hearing your confirmation of my findings in the case of my young friend." He stopped and smiled at me and sat down. The great Lama Chin Ro Robo also smiled and said, "Respected colleague, I gladly bow to your superior knowledge in accepting this young man for investigation. Respected colleague, your own talents are numerous. You are startlingly versatile, but never have you found such a boy as this." Then, of all things, they both laughed, and the Lama Chin Ro Nobo reached down somewhere behind him and took out 3 jars of pickled walnuts. I must have looked stupid, for they both turned toward me and started laughing. "Lobsang, you are not using your telepathic ability. If you were, you would be aware that the Reverend Lama and I were so sinful as to have a bet. It was agreed between us that if you came up to my statements, then the Reverend Medical Lama would give you 3 jars of pickled walnuts, whereas if you were not up to the standard claimed by me, I would do a long journey and undertake certain medical work for my friend." My guide smiled at me again and said, "Of course, I am going to do the journey for him in any case, and you will be going with me. But we had to get matters straight, and now honor is satisfied." He pointed to the 3 jars and said, "Put them by you, Lobsang, and when you leave here, when you leave this room, take them with you, for they're the spoils of the victor, and in this case, you are the victor." I really felt remarkably foolish. Obviously, I could not use telepathic powers on these 2 high lamas. The very thought of such a thing sent chill shivers along my spine. I loved my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, and I greatly respected the knowledge and wisdom of the great Lama Chin Ro Nobo. It would have been an insult It would have been bad manners indeed to have eavesdropped even telepathically. The Lama Chinrobo turned to me and said, "Yes, my boy, your sentiments do you credit. I am pleased indeed to greet you and to have you here among us. We will help you with your development." My guide said, "Now, Lobsang, you're going to have to stay in this particular building for perhaps a week, because you're going to be taught quite a lot about the aura." "Oh yes," he said, interpreting my glance. "I'm aware that you think you know all about the aura. You can see the aura and you can read the aura, but now you have to learn the whys and wherefores of it, and you have to learn how much the other fellow does not see. I am going to leave you now, but I shall see you tomorrow." He rose to his feet, and of course we rose as well. My guide made his farewells and then withdrew from that quite comfortable chamber. The Lama Chinrobo turned to me and said, "Do not be so nervous, Lobsang. Nothing's going to happen to you. We're merely going to try and help you and to expedite your own development. First of all, let us have a little discussion about the human aura. You, of course, see the aura vividly, and you can understand about the aura, but imagine that you were not so favored, not so gifted. Put yourself in the position of 99 9/10, or even more, of the world's population." He violently rang that little silver bell again, and once again the attendant came bustling in with tea, and of course the necessary other things, which most pleased me when I was having tea. It might be of interest here to say that we in Tibet sometimes drank in excess of 60 cups of tea in a day. Of course, Tibet is a cold country, and the hot tea warmed us. We were not able to get out and buy drinks such as people of the Western world had. We were limited to tea and sampa, unless some really kind-hearted person brought from a land such as India those things which were not available in Tibet. We settled down, and the Lama Chinrobo said, "We have already discussed the origin of the aura. It is the life force of a human body. I am going to assume for the moment, Lobsang, that you cannot see the aura, and that you know nothing about the aura, because only in assuming that can I tell you what the average person sees and does not see." I nodded my head to indicate that I understood. Of course, I had been born with the ability to see the aura and things like that, and those abilities had been increased by the operation of the third eye. And so on many occasions in the past, I had been almost trapped into saying what I saw without it dawning upon me that others did not see the same as I. I remembered an occasion sometime previously when I had said that a person was still alive, a person that old Sue and I had seen lying beside the road, and Sue had said that I was quite wrong, the man was dead. But I had said, "Sue, the man still has his lights on." Fortunately, as I realized after, The gale of wind which was blowing past us had distorted my words so that Sue had not comprehended the meaning. On some pulse, however, he had examined the man lying beside the road and found he was alive. But this is a digression. The average man and woman, Lob sang, cannot see the human aura. Some, indeed, hold to the belief that there is no such thing as a human aura. They might just as well say that there's no such thing as air, because they cannot see it. The medical llama looked at me to see if I was following him, or if my thoughts were straying walnut-wise. Satisfied with my appearance of attention, he nodded sagely and continued, "So long as there is life in a body, then there is an aura which can be seen by those with the power or the gift or ability, call it what you will." I must explain to you, Lob sang, that for the clearest perception of the aura, the subject who is being seen must be absolutely nude. We will discuss why later. It is sufficient just for ordinary readings to look at a person while they have some clothing on, but if you're going to look for anything whatever connected with the medical reason, then the person must be completely, absolutely nude. Well, completely enveloping the body and extending from the body for a distance of an eighth of an inch to 3 or 4 inches is the etheric sheath. This is a blue-gray mist. One can hardly call it a mist, for although it appears misty, one can see clearly through it. This etheric covering is the purely animal emanation. It derives particularly from the animal vitality of the body, so that a very healthy person will have a quite wide etheric. It may even be 3 or 4 inches from the body. Only the most gifted, Lob sang, perceive the next layer, for between the etheric and the aura proper, there is another band, perhaps 3 inches across, and one has to be gifted and talented indeed to see any colors in that band. I confess that I can see nothing but empty space there. I felt really gleeful about that, because I could see all the colors in that space, and I hastened to say so. "Yes, yes," Lob sang, "I know you can see in that space, for you are one of our most talented in this direction. But I was pretending that you could not see the aura at all, because I have to explain all this to you." The medical llama looked at me reprovingly. Reprovingly, no doubt, for interrupting the trend of his thoughts. When he thought that I was sufficiently subdued to refrain from further interruption, he continued, "First, then, there is the etheric layer. Following the etheric layer, there is that zone, which so few of us can distinguish except as an empty space. Outside of that is the aura itself. The aura does not so much depend upon the animal vitality as upon the spiritual vitality. The aura is composed of swirling bands and striations of all the colors of the visible spectrum, And that means more colors than can be seen with the physical eyes, for the aura is seen by other senses than the physical sight. Every organ in the human body sends out its own shaft of light, its shaft of rays, which alter and fluctuate as the thoughts of a person fluctuate. Many of these indications are present to a very marked degree in the etheric and in the space beyond. And when the nude body is seen, the aura appears to magnify the indications of health or disease, from which it is clear that those of us who are sufficiently clairvoyant can tell of a person's health or otherwise. I knew all about that. This was all child's play to me, and I had been practicing things like this ever since the operation for the third eye. I knew of the groups of medical lamas who sat beside suffering people and examined the nude body to see how they could be helped. I had thought, perhaps, that I was going to be trained for work such as that. "Now," said the medical lama, "you are being specially trained, highly trained, and when you go to that great Western world beyond our borders, it is hoped and thought that you may be able to devise an instrument whereby even those with no occult power at all will be able to see the human aura. Doctors seeing the human aura and actually seeing what is wrong with the person will be able to cure that person's illnesses. How, we shall discuss later. I know that all this is quite tiring, and much of that which I have told you is very well known indeed to you, but it may be tiring from this aspect. You are a natural clairvoyant. You may possibly never have thought of the mechanics of the operation of your gift, and that is a matter which must be remedied, because a man who knows only half a subject is only half trained and half useful. You, my friend, are going to be very useful indeed. But let us end this session now, Lobsang. We will repair to our own apartments, for one has been set aside for you. And then we can rest and think on those matters upon which we have so briefly touched. For this week, you will not be required to attend any service. That is by order of the Inmost One himself. All your energies, all your devotions, are to be directed solely to mastering the subjects which I and my colleagues are going to put before you." He rose to his feet, and I rose to mine. Once again that silver bell was seized in a mighty hand, and shaken so vigorously that I really felt that the poor thing would fall to pieces. The attendant monk came running in, and the medical lama, Chinro Nobo, said, "You will attend upon Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, for he's an honored guest here, as you are aware. Treat him as you would treat a visiting monk of high degree." He turned to me and bowed, and of course I hastily bowed back, and then the attendant beckoned for me to follow him. "Stop!" bawled the lama Chinro Nobo. "You have forgotten your walnuts." I rushed back and hastily grabbed up those precious jars, smiling somewhat in embarrassment as I did so. Then I hastened on to the waiting attendant. We went along a short corridor, and the attendant ushered me into a very nice room, which had a window overlooking the ferry across the happy river. "I am to look after you, master," said the attendant. "The bell is there for your convenience. Use it as you will." He turned and went out. I turned to that window. The view across the holy valley entranced me, for the ferry of inflated yak hides was just putting out from the shore, and the boatman was poling along across the swift river. On the other side, I saw, there were three or four men who, by their dress, must have been of some importance, an impression which was confirmed by the obsequious manner of the ferryman. I watched for some minutes, and then suddenly I felt more tired than I could imagine possible. I sat down upon the ground without even bothering about the seat cushion, and before I knew anything about it, I had toppled over backwards, asleep. The hours droned away to the accompaniment of clacking prayer wheels. Suddenly I sat up, bolt upright, quaking with fear. The service! I was late for the service. With my head on one side, I listened carefully. Somewhere a voice was chanting a litany. It was enough. I jumped to my feet and raced for the familiar door. It wasn't there. With a bone-jarring thud, I collided with the stone wall and fell bouncily onto my back. For a moment there was a blue-white flash inside my head as it too struck the stone. Then I recovered and sprang to my feet once more. Panicked by my lateness, I raced around the room, and there seemed to be no door, and worse, there was no window either. "Lapsang," said a voice from the darkness, "are you ill?" The voice of the attendant brought me back to my senses like a dash of ice water. "Oh," I said sheepishly, "I forgot. I thought I was late for service. I forgot I was excused." There was a subdued chuckle, and the voice said, "I will light the lamp, for it's very dark this night." A little glimmer came from the doorway. It was in a most unexpected place, and the attendant advanced towards me. "A most amusing interlude," he said. "I thought at first that a herd of yaks had broken loose and were in here." His smile robbed the words of all offense. I settled down again, and the attendant, with his light, withdrew. Across the lighter darkness that was the window, a shooting star flamed into incandescence, and it journeyed across the countless miles of space. I rolled over and slept. Breakfast was the same old dull and dreary sampa and tea, nourishing, sustaining, but uninspiring. Then the attendant came and said, "If you are ready, I have to take you elsewhere." I rose to my feet and walked with him out of the room. We went a different way this time. into a part of the Shakpori which I did not know existed. Downwards, a long way downwards, until I thought we were descending into the bowels of the Iron Mountain itself. Now there was no glimmer of light except from the lamps we carried. At last the attendants stopped and pointed ahead. "Go on, straight along, and turn into the room on the left." With a nod, he turned and retraced his steps. I trudged on, wondering, what now? The room on the left was before me. I turned into it and paused in amazement. The first thing to attract my attention was a prayer wheel standing in the middle of the room. I had time for only a brief glance at it, but even so, it appeared to be a very strange prayer wheel indeed. Then my name was spoken. "Well, Lobsang, we're glad you're here." I looked, and there was my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup. By his side sat the great medical Lama Chinro Nobo, and on the other side of my guide there sat a very distinguished-looking Indian Lama named Marfata. He had once studied Western medicine, and had indeed studied at some German university, which I believe was called Heidelberg. Now he was a Buddhist monk, a Lama, of course, but monk is the generic term. The Indian looked at me so searchingly, so piercingly, that I thought he must be looking at the material comprising the back of my robe. He seemed to look right through me. However, on this particular occasion, I had nothing bad on my conscience, and I returned his gaze. After all, why should I not gaze at him? I was as good as he, for I was being trained by the Lama Mingyar Dondup and by the great medical Lama Chinro Nobo. A smile forced its way across his rigid lips as if its execution caused him intense pain. He nodded and turned to my guide. "Yes, I am satisfied that the boy is as you say." My guide smiled, but there was no forcing of his smile. It was natural, spontaneous, and indeed warming to the heart. The great medical Lama said, "Lobsang, we have brought you down here to this secret room because we want to show you things and discuss things with you. Your guide and I have examined you, and we are indeed satisfied with your powers. Powers that are going to be increased in intensity. Our Indian colleague, Marfata, did not think that such a protege existed in Tibet. We hope that you will prove all our statements." I looked at that Indian and I thought, well, he is a man who has an exalted opinion of himself. I turned to the Lama Chinro Nobo and said, "Respected sir, the inmost one who has been good enough to give me an audience on a number of occasions has expressly cautioned me against giving proof, saying that proof was merely a palliative to the idle mind. Those who wanted proof were not capable of accepting the truth of a proof, no matter how well proven." The medical Lama Chinro Nobo laughed so that I almost feared I would be blown away by the gale of wind. My guide also laughed, and they both looked at the Indian Marfata, who looked sourly at me. "Boy," said the Indian, "you talk well, but talk proves nothing, as you yourself say. Now tell me, boy, what do you see in me?" I felt rather apprehensive about this, because much of what I saw I did not like. "Illustrious sir," I said, "I fear that if I say what I see, then you might indeed take it amiss and consider that I am merely insolent instead of replying to your question." My guide, the Lama Mingyardanda, nodded in agreement, and across the face of the great medical Lama, Chinro Nobo, a huge beaming smile expanded like the rising of the full moon. "Say what you will, boy, for we have no time for fancy talk here," said the Indian. For some moments I stood looking at the great Indian Lama, stood looking until even he stirred a little at the intensity of my gaze, and then I said, "Illustrious sir, you have commanded me to speak as I see, and I understand that my guide, the Lama Mingyardanda, and the great medical Lama, Chinro Nobo, also want me to speak frankly. Now this is what I see. I have never seen you before, but from your aura and from your thoughts, I detect this. You are a man who has traveled extensively, and you have traveled across the great oceans of the world. You have gone to that small island whose name I do not know, but here the people are all white, and where there is another small island lying nearby, as if it were a foal to the greater land, which was the mare. You were very antagonistic towards these people, and they were indeed anxious to take some action against you for something connected with..." I hesitated here, for the picture was particularly obscure. It was referring to things of which I had not the slightest knowledge. However, I plowed on. "There was something connected with an Indian city which I assume, from your mind, was Calcutta, and there was something connected with a black hole where the people of that island were gravely inconvenienced or embarrassed. In some way, they thought that you could have saved trouble instead of causing it." The great Lama, Chinro Nobo, laughed again, and it did my ears good to hear that laugh, because it indicated that I was on the right track. My guide gave no indication whatever, but the Indian snorted. I continued, "You went to another land, and I can see the name Heidelberg clearly in your mind. In that land, you studied medicine according to many barbarous rites, wherein you did much cutting and chopping and sawing, and did not use systems which we here in Tibet use. Eventually, you were given some sort of big paper with a lot of seals upon it. I also see from your aura that you are a man with an illness." I took a deep breath here, because I did not know how my next words would be received. The illness from which you suffer is one which has no cure. It is one in which the cells of the body run wild and grow as weeds grow, not according to pattern, not according to the ordained way, but spread and obstruct and clutch at vital organs. Sir, you are ending your own lifespan upon this earth by the nature of your thoughts, which admit of no goodness in the minds of others. For several moments, they may have been years to me, there was not a sound, and then the great medical lama, Shinro Nobo, said, "That is perfectly correct, Lobsang, that is perfectly correct." The Indian said, "The boy was probably primed about all this in advance." My guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, said, "No one has discussed you. On the contrary, much of what he's told us is news to us, for we have not investigated your aura, nor your mind, for you did not invite us to. But the main point at issue is, the boy, Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, has these powers, and the powers are going to be developed even further. We have no time for quarrels, no place for quarrels. Instead, we have serious work to do. Come." He rose to his feet and led me to that big prayer wheel. I looked at that strange thing and I saw that it was not a prayer wheel after all, but instead was a device standing about 4 feet high, 4 feet from the ground, and it was about 5 feet across. There were two little windows at one side, and I could see what appeared to be glass set in those windows. At the other side of the machine and set off center were two very much larger windows. At an opposite side, a long handle protruded, but the whole thing was a mystery to me. I had not the slightest idea of what it could be. The great medical lama said, "This is a device, Lobsang, with which those who are not clairvoyant can see the human aura." The great Indian Lama Marfata came here to consult us and would not tell us of the nature of his complaint, saying that if we knew so much about esoteric medicine, we would know his complaint without his telling us. We brought him here so that he could be examined with this machine. With his permission, he's going to remove his robe, and you're going to look at him first, and you're going to tell us just what his trouble is. Then we shall use this machine and see how far your findings and the findings of the machine coincide." My guide indicated a spot against the dark wall, and the Indian walked to it and removed his robe and other garments so that he stood brown and bare against the wall. "Lobsang, take a very good look at him and tell us what you see," said my guide. I looked not at the Indian, but some way to one side. I put my eyes out of focus, as that's the easiest way of seeing the aura. That is, I did not use normal binocular vision, but instead saw with each eye separately. It's a difficult thing indeed to explain, but it consists of looking with one eye to the left and one eye to the right. That is just a knack, a trick, which can be learned by almost anyone. I looked at the Indian, and his aura flowed and fluctuated. I saw that he was a great man indeed, and of high intellectual power, but, unfortunately, his whole outlook had been soured by the mysterious illness within him. As I looked at him, I spoke my thoughts, spoke them just as they came into my mind. I was not at all aware of how intently my guide and the great medical lama were listening to my words. It is clear that the illness has been brought on by many tensions within the body. The great Indian lama has been dissatisfied and frustrated, and that has acted against his health, causing the cells of his body to run wild, to escape from the direction of the over-self. Thus he has this complaint here. I pointed to his liver. And because he is a rather sharp-tempered man, his complaint is aggravated every time he gets cross. It is clear from his aura that if he would become more tranquil, more placid, like my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dandup, he would stay upon this earth longer, and so would accomplish more of his task without the necessity of having to come again. Once again there was a silence, and I was pleased to see that the Indian Lama nodded as if in complete agreement with my diagnosis. The medical Lama, Chinronobo, turned to that strange machine and looked through the little windows. My guide moved to the handle and turned with increasing force until a word from the medical Lama, Chinronobo, caused him to maintain the rate of rotation at constant speed. For some time, the Lama Chinronobo gazed through that device. Then he straightened up, and without a word, the Lama Mingyur Dandup took his place, while the medical Lama Chinronobo turned the handle as had previously my guide. Eventually, they finished their examination and stood together, obviously conversing by telepathy. I made no attempt whatever to intercept their thoughts, because to do so would have been a gross slight and would have put me above my station. At last, they turned to the Indian and said, "All that Tuesday Lobsang Rampa has told you is correct. We have examined your aura most thoroughly, and we believe that you have cancer of the liver. We believe also that this has been caused by certain shortness of temper. We believe that if you will lead a quiet life, you still have a number of years left to you, years in which you can accomplish your task. We are prepared to make representations so that if you agree to our plan, you will be permitted to remain here at Chakpori." The Indian discussed matters for a time and then motioned to Chinronobo. Together they left the room. My guide, the Lama Mingyur Dandup, patted me on the shoulder and said, "Well done, Lobsang, well done. And now I want to show this machine to you." He walked across to that very strange device and lifted up one side of the top. The whole thing moved, and inside I saw a series of arms radiating from a central shaft. At the extreme end of the arms there were prisms of glass in ruby red, blue, yellow, and white. As the handle was turned, belts connected from it to the shaft caused the arms to rotate, and I observed that each prism in turn was brought to the line which was seen by looking through the two eyepieces. My guide showed me how the thing worked and then said, "Of course, this is a very crude and clumsy affair. We use it here for experiment, and in the hope of one day producing a smaller version." "You would never need to use it," Lob sang, "but there are not many who have the power of seeing the aura as clearly as you do. At some time I shall explain the working in more detail, but briefly, it deals with the heterodyne principle, wherein rapidly rotating colored prisms interrupted the line of sight, and thus destroy the normal image of the human body, and intensify the much weaker rays of the aura." He replaced the lid and turned away to another device, standing on a table at a far corner. He was just leading the way to that table when the medical lama, Chinro Nobo, came into the room again and joined us. "Ah," he said, coming over to us, "so you were going to test his thought power? Good, I must be in on this." My guide pointed to a queer cylinder of what appeared to be rough paper. "This," Lob sang, "is thick, rough paper. You will see that it has innumerable holes made in it, holes made with a very blunt instrument, so that the paper is torn and leaves projections. We then folded that paper so that all the projections were on the outside, and the sheet, instead of being flat, formed a cylinder. Across the top of the cylinder, we affixed the rigid straw, and upon a small pedestal, we fixed a sharp needle. Thus, we have the cylinder supported on an almost frictionless bearing. Now watch me." He sat down and put his hands on either side of the cylinder, not touching the cylinder, but leaving about an inch and a half space between his hands and the projections. Soon, the cylinder started to spin, and I was astounded as the thing picked up speed and was soon rotating at quite a merry rate. My guide stopped it with a touch, placed his hands in the opposite direction, so that the fingers, instead of pointing away from his body, as had been the case, now pointed toward his body. The cylinder started to spin, but in the opposite direction. "You are blowing on it," I said.
"Everyone says that," said the medical lama Chinro Nobo, "but they're completely wrong."
The great medical lama went to a recess in the far wall and returned bearing a sheet of glass. It was quite a thick sheet, and he carried it carefully to my guide, the lama Mingyar Dondup.
My guide stopped the cylinder from rotating and sat quiet while the great medical lama, Chinronobo, placed the sheet of glass between my guide and the paper cylinder. Think about rotation, said the medical lama. My guide apparently did so, for the cylinder started to rotate again. It was quite impossible for my guide or for anyone else to have blown on the cylinder and made it rotate because of the glass. He stopped the cylinder again and then turned to me and said, "You try it, Lobsang." He rose from his seat and I took his place. I sat down and placed my hands just as had my guide. The medical lama, Chinronobo, held the sheet of glass in front of me so that my breath would not influence the rotation of the cylinder. I sat there feeling like a fool. Apparently the cylinder thought I was one too, for nothing happened. "Think of making it rotate, Lobsang," said my guide. I did so, and immediately the thing started to go round. For a moment I felt like dropping everything and running. I thought the thing was bewitched, and then reason, sort of, prevailed, and I just sat still. "That device, Lobsang," said my guide, "runs by the force of the human aura. You think of rotating it, and your aura puts a swirl on the thing, which causes it to turn. You may be interested to know that a device such as this has been experimented with in all the greater countries of the world. All the greatest scientists have tried to explain away the workings of this thing, but Western people, of course, cannot believe in etheric force, and so they invent explanations which are even stranger than the actual force of the etheric." The great medical lama said, "I am feeling quite hungry, Mingyar Dondup. I feel it's time we repaired to our rooms for rest and for sustenance. We must not tax the young man's abilities nor his endurance, for he will get enough of that in the future." We turned, and the lights were extinguished in that room, and we made our way up the stone corridor and into the main building of the Shakpori. Soon, I was in a room with my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup. Soon, happy thought, I was consuming food and feeling the better for it. "Eat well, Lobsang," said my guide, "for later in the day we shall see you again and discuss with you other matters." For an hour or so I rested in my room, looking out the window, because I had a weakness. I always liked to look from high places and watch the world moving beneath. I loved to watch the traders wending their slow way through the western gate, their every step indicating their delight at having reached the end of a long and arduous journey through the high mountain passes. Traders in the past had told me of the wonderful view there was from a certain spot on a high pass where, as one came from the Indian border, one could look down between a cleft in the mountains and gaze upon the sacred city, with its rooftops agleam with gold, and off by the side of the mountains the white walls of the rice heap, looking indeed like a heap of rice, as it sprawled in bounteous profusion down the side of the mountainous slopes. I loved to watch the ferryman crossing the happy river, and I hoped always for the sight of a puncture in his inflated hide boat. I longed to watch him gradually sink from sight until only his head protruded above the water. But I was never that fortunate. The ferryman always reached the other side, took on his load, and returned again. Soon, once more, I was in that deep room with my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondop, and the great medical Lama Shinro Nobo. "Lobsang," said the great medical Lama, "you must be sure that if you're going to examine a patient in order that you may assist him or her, the clothes be entirely removed." "Honorable medical Lama," I said in some confusion, "I can think of no reason why I should deprive a person of their clothing in this cold weather, for I can see their aura perfectly clearly without their being any need whatsoever to remove a single garment. And, oh, respected medical Lama, how could I possibly ask a woman to remove her clothing?" My eyes rolled upwards in horror at the mere thought. I must have presented quite a comical figure, for both my guide and the medical Lama burst out laughing. They sat down and really enjoyed themselves with their laughter. I stood in front of them feeling quite remarkably foolish, but really I was quite puzzled about these things. I could see an aura perfectly, with no trouble at all, and I saw no reason why I should depart from what was my own normal practice. "Lobsang," said the medical Lama, "you are a very gifted clairvoyant, but there are some things which you do not yet see. We have had a remarkable demonstration from you of your ability in seeing the human aura, but you would not have seen that liver complaint of the Indian Lama Marfata if he had not removed his clothing." I reflected upon this, and when I thought about it, I had to admit that it was correct. I had looked at the Indian Lama while he'd been robed, and while I had seen so much about his character and basic traits, I still had not noticed the liver complaint. "You are perfectly correct, Honorable Medical Lama," I said, "but I should like some further training from you in this matter." My guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondop, looked at me and said, "When you look at a person's aura, you want to see the person's aura. You're not concerned with the thoughts of the sheep whence came the wool which was made into a robe. Every aura is influenced by that which interferes with its direct rays. We have here a sheet of glass, and if I breathe upon that glass, it will affect what you see through the glass. Similarly, although this glass is transparent, it actually does alter the light, or rather the color of the light, which you would see when looking through it. In the same way, if you look through a piece of colored glass, all the vibrations which you receive from an object are altered in intensity by the action of the colored glass. Thus it is that a person whose body has upon it clothing or ornaments of any kind has his aura modified according to the etheric content of the clothing or ornament. I thought about it, and I had to agree that there was quite a lot in what he said. He continued, "A further point is this. Every organ of the body projects its own picture, its own state of health or sickness, onto the etheric, and the aura, when uncovered and free from the influence of clothes, magnifies and intensifies the impression which one receives. Thus it is quite definite that if you are going to help a person in health or in sickness, then you will have to examine him without his clothing." He smiled at me and said, "And if the weather be cold, why then, Lobsang, you'll have to take him to a warmer place." "Honorable Lama," I said, "some time ago you told me that you were working on a device which would enable one to cure illness through the aura." "That's perfectly correct, Lobsang," said my guide. "Illness is merely a dissonance in the body vibrations. An organ has its rate of molecular vibration disturbed, and so it is considered to be a sick organ. If we could actually see how much the vibration of an organ departs from the normal, then by restoring the rate of vibration to what it should have been, we have effected a cure. In the case of a mental affliction, the brain usually receives messages from the overself which it cannot correctly interpret, and so the actions resulting are those which depart from that which is accepted as normal actions for a human. Thus, if the human is not able to reason or to act in a normal manner, he is said to have some mental ailment. By measuring the discrepancy, the understimulation, we can assist a person to recover normal balance. The vibrations may be lower than normal, resulting in understimulation, or they may be higher than normal, which would give an effect similar to that of a brain fever. Quite definitely, illness can be cured by intervention through the aura. The great medical lama interrupted here and said, "By the way, respected colleague, the Lama Marfata, was discussing this matter with me, and he said that at certain places in India, certain secluded lamasaries, they were experimenting with a very high voltage device known as, I believe it's called, a DeGraaf generator." He was a bit uncertain about his terms, but he was making a truly manful effort to give us the exact information. This generator apparently developed an extraordinarily high voltage at an extraordinarily low current. Applied in a certain way to the body, it caused the intensity of the aura to increase many, many times, so that even the non-clairvoyant could clearly observe it. I'm also told that photographs have been taken of a human aura under these conditions. My guide nodded solemnly and said, "Yes, it is also possible to view the human aura by means of a special dye, a liquid which is sandwiched between two plates of glass. By arranging appropriate lighting and background, and viewing the nude human body through this screen, many people can indeed see the aura. I burst in and said, "But honorable sirs, why do people have to use all these tricks? I can see the aura, why can't they?" My two mentors laughed again. This time, they did not feel it necessary to explain the difference between training such as I had had and the training of the average man or woman in the street. The medical lama said, "Now we probe in the dark. We try to cure our patients by rule of thumb, by herbs, by pills and potions. We're like blind men trying to find a pin dropped on the ground. I would like to see a small device so that any non-clairvoyant person could look through this device and see the human aura, see all the faults of the human aura, and in seeing, would be able to cure the discrepancy or the deficiency which truly was the cause of the illness." For the rest of that week, I was shown things by hypnotism and by telepathy, and my powers were increased and intensified, and we had talk after talk on the best ways to see the aura and to develop a machine which would also see the aura, and then, upon the last night of that week, went to my little room in the Shakpori and looked out the window, thinking that on the morrow I would return again to that bigger dormitory where I slept in company with so many others. I glanced down and saw the last dying rays peering over the rocky rim of our valley, flicking the golden roofs as if with sparkling fingers, sending up showers of golden light, and in doing so breaking the light into iridescent colors, which were of the spectrum of the gold itself, blues and yellows and reds and even some green, struggled to attract the eye, growing dimmer and dimmer as the light faded. Soon the valley itself was encased in dark velvet, a dark blue violet or purple velvet, which could almost be felt. Through my open window I could smell the scent of the willows and the scent of plants in the garden so far below me. A vagrant breeze wafted stronger scents to my nostrils, pollen and the budding flowers. The last dying rays of the sun sank completely out of sight. No more did those probing fingers of light come over the edge of our rock-bound valley. Instead, they shot off into the darkening sky and reflected on low-lying clouds, showing red and blue. Gradually, the night became darker as the sun sank further and further beyond our world. Soon there were bright specks of light in the dark purple sky, the light of Saturn, of Venus, and of Mars. And then came the light of the moon, hanging gibbous in the sky with all the pockmarks showing plain and clear, and across the face of the moon drifted a light fleecy cloud. It reminded me of a woman drawing a garment across herself after having been examined through her aura. I turned away, resolved in every fiber of my being that I would do all I could to help increase the knowledge of the human aura and to help those who went out into the great world and brought help and ease to suffering millions. I lay down upon the stone floor, and almost as soon as my head touched my folded robe, I fell asleep and knew no more. End of chapter 8.